come now to Matthew 20, verse 17, and we'll read down through verse 28. So let us hear the word of the Lord. And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside, and on the way he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day." Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one on your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And the Lord will bless the reading of his word. This is a remarkable passage for many reasons, one of which is just the sheer patience of Christ and his mercy to his disciples, because this is not the first time that they have wrestled or maybe bickered among themselves as to who's going to be great or seeking a place of prominence. And we know in Luke's gospel, this is not going to be the last time that they have that particular battle amongst themselves. Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield, in his famous message on Philippians 2 called Imitating the Incarnation, opened with these words, "Christ, our example. After Christ, our Redeemer, no words can more deeply stir the Christian heart than these, to be like Christ." It is, I would say, the great desire of every Christian. If you could be asked, what is the one thing that you desire? And you're given time to give an answer, and you can cut through all of maybe those immediate things that come to your mind that you know maybe aren't ultimate. I think at the heart of every believer is the desire to be like Jesus. And we often pray, do we not? "Lord, make me more like Christ." And I often wonder if we really know what we're asking. Because the means by which the Spirit makes us like Christ is not always easy, as the disciples here are going to find out. The greatest battle, really, that we have is the battle of self. It is natural for us to want a place of prominence. It's natural for us to want to be promoted, to be seen, to be acclaimed. But what the gospel calls us to be is not natural. The gospel calls us to be humble. Now, historically, humility was not viewed as a virtue, even in the Greek and Roman empires. With Aristotle even, humility and modesty of life was actually a vice. It was a sign of weakness. But here Christ comes as the great teacher, the one who teaches with a kind of authority that nobody had ever seen. He comes along and says, we're called to be humble. Now, Aristotle would go on and even say that humility is a characteristic of children. But once they grow to maturity, they need to put that aside. But remember what Jesus has been emphasizing in Matthew 18 and 19. When the disciples first have their battle about this in 18, right? They're actually talking to themselves, who's the greatest among us? What does Jesus do? He holds up a child. And where Aristotle would say that is a vice, that's weakness, Christ holds up a child and says, this is the model. And then in chapter 19, as they're still wrestling with this place of prominence, remember the disciples are preventing parents from bringing their children to Jesus because Jesus is too important. And children aren't. And what does Christ say? Bring them, let them come to me. And now he holds them up, not just as a model for the kingdom, but of such is the kingdom. Children even can have a full share in the kingdom of God and have this equal status as adults or even the 12 disciples. And then, remember, Jesus goes on and he gives this exchange with this rich young ruler who his heart is exposed and he becomes really devastated because he wants to do something to inherit the kingdom and he turns away because Christ has called him out on his covetousness and his desire for possessions. And Peter looks and says, we're in a good spot. We've given everything. What will we get? And Jesus starts talking about thrones. It's like, there's going to be 12 thrones and you're going to sit on those. Well, everything that has happened after the comment about thrones, and Jesus is talking about the kingdom and all these things, apparently the disciples can't get thrones out of their head. You know, it's kind of like you talk to someone about something and you mention one word that's not really the great substance of everything. You then spend 15 minutes and in your mind you're thinking, this is a fantastic monologue. I bet they're being persuaded and convinced. And then they respond with, hey, so this thing about thrones, this is fantastic, right? And so what's happening here is Jesus is about to tell him for the third time with greater clarity the most important thing. And so the context of this remarkable passage is Jesus' foretelling of his death in verses 17 through 19 in great clarity. This is the third time. Remember, back in chapter 16, he says that he's going to be taken by the religious leaders, and he's going to be killed. Then in chapter 18, he says that he's going to be killed, but he's going to be raised. But now in this third time, he gives even more information. He says, the religious leaders are going to hand me over to the Gentiles. So now everybody around is involved in what's about to happen to Jesus. The religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees, they all reject Christ, hand him over to be killed. The Romans, the Gentiles here, they're going to take him and crucify him. And Jesus now is being very explicit about what is about to happen to him. He's going to be mocked. He's going to be flogged, and he's going to be crucified. And Lord willing, in the weeks ahead, we're going to be meditating on those events, the mocking, the flogging, and the crucifixion. But right in the heart of that, as he tells them, in a sense, it's now time. The hour for which I have come is here. We need to make our way to Jerusalem. It's at that moment that we have this reminder of self. So what I want to consider tonight really is just two broad themes. One is the blinding danger of selfish pride, and the second one is the glorious freedom of following Christ. And in some ways, it's a somewhat humorous story and request because of its timing, because of the players involved. This is really pertaining to James and John. These are two of the three of that inner circle of the 12. And out of those three, this involves the one that was most dear to Christ, John, the one Jesus loved. And it's a reminder to us that no matter how close we dwell with Christ, until the resurrection day, we're not going to be fully glorified in body and soul. That in this life, we need to wrestle with this battle of pride and selfishness. But the account here has another individual, and that is their mother. This is, if you put some pieces together in church tradition, it's possibly Salome, who was related to Mary. So this possibly is someone who's related to Jesus. And so James and John have their mother come up to Jesus and make a request that they were in full support of. Now, it's not uncommon or unnatural for parents to desire great things for their children. Her desire for good things for her children is not in itself bad. It's what the particular desire here was at the expense of others. And so we see here this blinding danger of selfish pride. They come to Jesus and she kneels with her sons before him. And he says, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit one of your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." So we have here this blinding danger of self-advancement. And I want to say here that what Christ is reacting to is not the pursuit of excellence. We are all to pursue excellence according to the gifts and abilities and talents that the Lord gives to us for his glory. But here, this desire here of self-advancement is something that comes from within that desires a place of prominence. And to ask for the right hand and the left hand, this is a place of prestige. This is a place of prominence. It's a place of power. It's a place of great fanfare. And we know a bit of this on maybe a lesser level when we name drop, when we say, "Oh, I know this person," or "Oh, good friends with this person or that person," if that name comes up. And here, they know that Jesus is coming in to Jerusalem. And again, they're still thinking that the establishment of his kingdom is maybe an overthrow and he will establish his throne in just a few days. And they want to know when he does that. James and John have the right hand and the left hand. That place of proximity closest to the one on the throne. And that is what they request. So Jesus responds to them, and he does so in his usual brilliant way to draw out from them the ramifications of what they ask to see. And he says to them, "You do not know what you're asking." So here we see oftentimes with pride is not just a desire for self-advancement and self-promotion, but there's also a bit of self-deception, where we have a greater thought of ourselves than what really needs to be. There was a popular author, American novelist, Philip Roth, who died a few years ago, and this author received probably the major awards for fiction that you could receive, the Pulitzer Prize and all of these things. And he presented himself as someone who wanted to support art for art's sake, and he was sincere in all that he did. But after he died in 2018 and his letters were opened up for biographical purposes, it became clear that he was actually manipulating a lot of things for his own selfish ambition, and he was becoming good friends with literary critics who sat on the committees to give out the awards. And there's one letter of a committee member who congratulates Roth on the award he received and then says, "Would you be willing to dust off that letter of recommendation for me for the academic promotion in X place?" And so there was a lot of behind the scenes moving and shaking and wheeling and dealing, and it exposed the heart. You might have an appearance of humility, but here, there is this idea of self-deception. And as much as Roth tried to convince himself that he was pure, so the disciples had a false sense of what they could accomplish. And so Jesus says to them, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" Now, this phrase, this cup, again, filled with Old Testament imagery, and the disciples would have known that this is the cup of suffering. This is the cup of wrath. And at one level, no one can drink the cup in the way that Jesus drinks the cup. We do not imitate him in his substitutionary atonement, but we will imitate him in suffering. And so they had a self-confidence and a self-deception. And you see this in their response. "Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" And they said to him, "We are. We're good. We've got this." And Jesus says to them, "But you will. And I'm not quite sure right now you know what you're asking." They're asking for the crown without the path of suffering to attain it. And if you remember, that is at the very heart of Satan's great temptation of Jesus. "You bow to me and I will give you all of this. You can bypass all of that other stuff, all that death, bypass the cup. And you can have all of it." And how often do we want to bypass the path that Christ calls us to in order to attain the crown? But Jesus does say, he goes, "You will drink my cup, James is going to be the first apostolic martyr. We read of that in Acts 12. John is the last apostle to die, but his path was not one of ease. We know in Revelation that he was exiled on the island of Patmos, and according to church tradition, for his following Christ, he was boiled in a vat of oil and survived. Someone who suffered greatly. And they understood in time what it was to follow Christ. And at that moment, you would want to see the disciples here say, ah, you know what, you're right. This desire for prominence and prestige is probably not the best. But we see another blindness, and that is self-interest. By all. Verse 24, when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. And based on Christ's response, we know that they were not indignant in a righteous way. They were indignant because of their own self-interest. There's only one spot right next to the throne on the right and one spot right next to the throne on the left, but yet there's 12 of these. And it wasn't just James and John and their mom who wanted it. It was all of them. And so now you have the 12 angry at one another because they want the promotion. They want the advancement. They want the place. And Jesus turns to them. And he says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. The way of rulership in the Roman Empire was not one of what we hear often in the church, servant leadership. It was cruel. It was heavy-handed. It didn't matter if you were related to them. They'll kill you to keep their throne. And they treat their subjects with a heaviness. And Jesus says very simply, it's not going to be that way among you. If there's any lesson you take from this 12, it will not be so among you. That there's no openness to dialogue here on this one. It's not, you know, I'd prefer if y'all kind of ruled maybe a little softer. It's like, no, it will not be so. And so how does Jesus view heavy-handed lording over his people? Not as a matter of indifference. It's a big thing to him. And he wants his disciples to see. But what is absolutely remarkable so far is not really all that's been revealed. What's remarkable is what's next. And that is the glorious freedom of imitating Christ. When he says this in verse 28, about if you want to be great, you're debating over greatness, you're dealing with who wants to be first, but here's what I want you to see, this word, even as. If you want to be great, you become a servant. If you want to be first, you become a slave. And that would have been mind-boggling in the Roman Empire to elevate a slave to a place of leadership and prompt, that is unheard of. But Christ is in my kingdom. If you want to be that, you be this, And then he says, even as the Son of Man. Now, sometimes we think this word Son of Man has to do with his humanity. But if we go back to the book of Daniel and we see the description of the Son of Man is actually a title of deity and divinity and power. And you remember in Daniel 7 when he talks about the Son of Man coming in the glory of the clouds and the one who rules over all and sustains all and governs all and everyone will be subject to that. You think this is one who, by virtue of who he is, could easily demand that all those around him serve him. And he says, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. And here's an echo of Isaiah 53, this one who makes himself as that suffering servant, the one who lays down his life for others. And when we walk through all of who this Son of Man is, this is the eternal Son of God. This is the object of the Father's delight. This is the one who enjoyed that fellowship in the bosom of the Father of just pure, unlimited love and affection. He takes upon himself humanity. And I wonder if there's one truth that if we could give our attention to for the remainder of our lives and never be able to plumb the depths of it, it is the incarnation. God manifest in the flesh. God, eternal God, triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And we teach this to our children, right? When we go through the catechism, what is God? The very first thing they recite is God is a spirit. God is a spirit. Moses longed to see God's face, and God says, look, man, you behold my glory, you're dead. And he hides him in a rock and he passes by. And what Moses did see is the passing glory of God was more than he could bear. And now, God in the flesh, this Word who is with God, who is God, takes on flesh and dwells among us. You ever thought what it would have been like? Remember what John says in 1 John 1? This is the one, I mean, we sat with him. We ate with him. We could touch him. Can you imagine? The hands of Christ are the hands of God. And this Son of Man, who is all glorious, he comes for one purpose: to redeem and rescue us from our sin by becoming obedient unto death, even the death of the cross, this shameful death of the cross. This is a manner of execution that was forbidden among the Jews. The Jews could not crucify someone. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. They had to deliver him over to the Romans. But yet they cried out, crucify him. And Christ, went willingly and lovingly to the cross to give his life a ransom for us. And this is what Paul holds forth, right? As he who was in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself a nobody. Here we are trying to make a name for ourselves in a kingdom that will pass away. And Christ, the King of the kingdom that has no end, makes himself of no account. He passed through the streets of Galilee, and no one turned their head. There was nothing about him that cried out, "I am the King." Humble, sacrificial. The Son of Man came to serve. This word, serve, is the word we get deacon. Now, the word here is not referring to that office, but it does shape our understanding. And even that, right? Even that, you know, and I think Pastor Brian alluded to this a couple weeks ago, that the diaconate is not a stepping stone to the session. Right? But sometimes it's viewed that way. From Christ's perspective, he cares so much for his church that he creates an office that reflects the very description of his life, which is to serve. He comes to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. This is greatness that lasts. Again, Christ is not saying don't pursue excellence. This is tomorrow's Reformation Day. One of the great gifts of the Reformation is that Protestant work ethic, that we work diligently because of who God is, and we seek to glorify him in all that we do. That's not what this is objecting to. This is objecting to, well, I don't need to do that action. That's for someone else because I'm fill in the blank. Or I'm not going to give of myself or my time anymore because when I did, no one thanked me. Or, I don't want there to be any growth or adding on because I like to have the central place. Or whatever it is that we find ourselves pulled to do. If Christ can touch a leper, if Christ can raise that corpse, and remember, he came as a Jew. He understood this ceremonial uncleanness, but if he can come and touch a corpse and have greater power over that corpse than that corpse could have on him, then why can't we take out the proverbial trash? It's interesting that this passage in Philippians 2, which is probably the greatest passage on the incarnation, that both are in the context of the most pertinent application. So this whole thing of doctrine doesn't apply, that's just bunkum. We dismiss that. If we want to know how we are to live amongst one another, if we want to know how we interact one with each other, in the church, in the home, at the lunch table at school, There's no better truth to meditate on than the incarnation. If Christ, who is who he is, takes on flesh to do what he did, then what task or action or act of love could ever be said to be beneath any of us? So let us follow Christ. Let us look like Christ. Let us have the heart of Christ, where we desire to give ourselves for others. It's something that the world scoffs at, but so be it. Let us follow Christ.